startups don't survive Amazon's attacks, but Square somehow did. What explains that?
Jim McKelvey, co-founder of Block, formerly known as Square, which he built with Jack Dorsey into a generational company, now valued at more than $50 billion.
Are there particular motivations that lead to the highest probability of success?
Oh, yes. At some point in your life, you're going to find a problem that the world has not solved yet. Every fiber of your body will tell you you're wrong. Don't accept the lack of qualification as an excuse. You're not qualified to do this new thing. Neither is anybody else on the planet.
Jim is a technology pioneer, audacious entrepreneur, and the renowned author of The Innovation Stack.
What is driving you to build these things?
My mom's suicide was one that I didn't take any action. I could have done more to save my mother, and I didn't. And I feel that guilt.
Has being a billionaire actually changed your daily life?
Yeah, but it wasn't all positive.
What is a use case of AI that you're most excited about in the near future? Like, where do you see AI having the biggest opportunity to disrupt and actually create a better world?
Well, I've been using it personally to develop software, which is fantastic. I mean, it's a 20x output improvement.
That much?
It is. Oh my God, it's amazing. We can do things so quickly and so well that it's now making bad design really dangerous. So in the old days, like, you could poorly design something, but because it took you, you know, let's say 4,000 man hours to make the next iteration, you didn't have a lot of leeway. And if somebody pushed back with some, you know, sort of crap piece of software, which I've always rebelled against, like, my entire career has basically been fighting bad design. Now I've got this weapon because I just say, get out of that seat and I will fix it myself. And even though my coding skills are no good compared to really good coders, they don't have to be anymore. So it's now the question of what do you want to build? What's the experience you're trying to create for the user? And that's front and center. And that's all that really differentiates any software now. So that, I think, is a huge advantage with AI. Look, there's the obvious stuff. It's going to replace a ton of, you know, sort of white collar busy work. And that's a social danger, but it's also a huge benefit. And hopefully you believe that the economy is resilient enough to reallocate those resources. That's going to be a wild ride too. That is going to be very, very disruptive, because once corporate America wakes up to how much that they're paying for doesn't actually need a human, there will be fewer humans working.
That is a fact. What would you say for people that are listening that might be intimidated by AI? They're not really in the tech ecosystem. And they're like, okay, I'm a knowledge worker. I got to think about how I should be leveraging AI and stay ahead of the curve here. What are some practical tools or strategies that you would recommend to people?
So first of all, I'd say that fear is well-founded.
Yeah.
Like, if you are afraid, you're paying attention. Okay. Now the question is, okay, I got this one lifeboat and I'm The Titanic is sinking, and there are 13 seats on this boat. And, you know, it's not the 1900s. We're not just going to give it to the first class ticket holders. You're going to have to earn one of your seats, and those seats will be earned by true contribution in the things that still matter. So how are you dealing with your customers? How are you producing value for whatever your stakeholder class is? I mean, and I know those are vague terms, but like, if I was an accountant right now, I would sit there and say, I now have to be 50 accountants because that's the leverage that I'm going to get in the next year from these tools. So what do I do that represents the output of 50 accountants? Like, do I single-handedly, you know, take on public auditing tasks, like one person, you know, or what am I doing where I can be one of the people on the lifeboat? I mean, assuming you want to do it. You know, the other thing you'd say is, well, okay, this ship is sinking and I'm just going to take a helicopter somewhere else, you know, and just, you know, eject and do a different career. I mean, I don't know how many careers I have. I was just joking the other day because I got something called an ATP, which allows me to essentially work for United Airlines. And I was joking with my family, like, look, if everything goes to hell, I can get a job flying planes for United.
Wow, because yeah. I know you're a pilot, so you can actually fly United aircrafts?
Well, I mean, no, they have to hire me first, but I mean, like, the you know, it's basically private pilot, commercial pilot, and then there's this thing called an ATP, which you really only get if you're going to fly planes for a living. But I was kind of like, well, I wonder if I could do it. I spent a bunch of time. But I mean, and I was joking when I said to my parents, or one of my family, that, hey, look, if everything else burns to the ground, you know, and the Bitcoin all gets stolen and all this other stuff, you know, we're fine because daddy can go fly Boeings. Yeah. You know, I think one of the wonderful things about AI and the world and podcasts like this, look, knowledge is freely available. Knowledge, freely available. Anything they teach at MIT, freely available. Anything you want to learn. I mean, unless it's like some secret thing, which there are very few secret things anymore.
You're right.
You can do it. And now the question is, are you the sort of person who wants to switch careers? You know, and maybe you were an accountant and maybe accounting is going away. Like, I've got a friend right now who, you know, worked at an investment firm, and I can't name the name of the firm, but he caught him doing something they shouldn't have been doing. I said, well, why don't you go work for the government? Like, why don't you, instead of like trying to make money for rich people, go and try to enforce the laws? I try to make sure that there's less theft of people's assets. And this was a case of that. And so, you know, I think you could switch careers these days. And if you don't have the skills for the new career, well, you know, that's 6 months, the speed at which you can ingest knowledge and have, you know, AI tutors. And but a lot of the times you don't even need to learn the new stuff because the new stuff is becoming irrelevant. You just need to know what you don't know. It's this amazing world. And I think it would be scary, but also super fun.
What I love about your story, too, is I think that you've pivoted many times. You've had a lot of careers. I know you were in tech. You founded a company. It's where you'd met Jack when he was your intern. Then you were taking some time doing glass blowing. You're a pilot. And you've been able to go through these pivots, right? Where you've been able to kind of retool, rebuild yourself. I want to dive more into the Square and Block story, because I think it's one of the best tech stories of our generation. But I think there's a lot of really great lessons packed in there. For the people who don't know the story, can you share how you and Jack ended up banding together and how you guys ended up starting Square?
Yeah, happy to. But I mean, I would argue that I don't pivot. I just parallel. So the pivot is, Stum's not working, switch. I don't do that. I mean, in my world, something's not working, I will keep going and keep going and keep going. Like, Square didn't pivot at all. We did add Cash App. We did add Bitcoin mining. We did add, we added stuff, but like the original reader, that thing still works. The original software, well, it's a bigger suite now, but it's like, there was no pivot. My glass blowing. I was literally at a glass conference in St. Louis this weekend with some of the best glass artists in the world, including Janusz Pozniak, who I think is the best pair of hands on the planet right now. I mean, I love Lino, but he's in his 80s, and Janusz is just amazing. I was blowing glass with some of the best glass blowers in the world. I haven't left the art world. I still fly. So this idea of the pivot, I'm not a guy who pivots. I'm a guy who just adds the new thing. That does cause time allocation problems. But, you know, these days, you know, I've got AI to help me, and I got a lot of support that I use. And you know, I guess I left the Fed, but that was because I termed out. You know, I can't vote on interstates anymore because they limit you to 6 years. I mean, hell, if they hadn't kicked me off, I would still be doing that. To your basic question was how we started Square. So true story, I was in my glass studio trying to sell a piece of glass to a lady from Panama. She was on the phone, and she only had an American Express card, which I can't take because the take rates at American Express were too high. I was normally able to steer all my customers to a MasterCard or Visa, but she didn't have one. And so I lost this sale and I was pissed. And I looked at, you know, my phone and I said, you know, this device should magically turn into whatever I want it to. You know, it turns into a camera, it turns into a TV, it turns into a, you know, a map, but it didn't magically turn into a credit card machine. So that was the idea that I had. I want my phone to magically turn into a credit card machine so I don't lose another sale. I called Jack. We'd already started the company. We were going to go down a different path. But it was, you know, like second week of the company. And so I said, we should, I mean, maybe that was a pivot.
But one or two in there.
But I got I was like, well, that other idea I'm not excited about, but I am excited about getting paid personally. So that's where the original direction from Square came from. And then we just got amazingly lucky. We started in the middle of a recession, so we had access to great talent. It turns out that the problem that I had was shared by millions of other small businesses who also needed support. We hit this beautiful unclaimed territory. And that was because of, you know, right product, right time. But I mean, there was a lot of luck in that.
Yeah. What was your thought process on making Jack the CEO? Because you had worked with him at Mira. He was your intern when he was younger.
Yeah.
And then you come back together and you're building this new company. You landed on this idea that seems big. You're scratching your own itch. This is the big thing we want to focus on. Why make Jack CEO?
If he wanted it, and I didn't. I mean, that was the easiest conversation in the world. Like we were pretty much even equity wise in the beginning. I mean, he had a little more because he was, he had just had Twitter, and I had, you know, a bunch of stuff in the Midwest, but nothing in the tech world. You know, then the question was, well, who should run this? And I'm a lousy CEO. Like I'm provably bad. Partially because I keep doing other stuff and my focus isn't great and I don't like sitting through meetings or stuff. So I don't want to be the CEO. So I don't ever start anything by myself. I will always team up with a group and offload onto that group my weaknesses, I don't know all my weaknesses, but I know enough of them to sort of, you know, pick a good partner. Jack's a great partner for me because we're quite different. So Jack wanted to be CEO. I didn't want to be CEO. Boom. So Jack was CEO. Nope. That was great.
Easy math there. Well, tell me this, because you guys were doing something that hadn't been done before at the time. And I'm curious how you even came up with the idea of the innovation stack. It's an amazing book for anyone who hasn't read it. But where did the idea of the innovation stack come into, and how did that play into the building of Square?
So the innovation stack, which is a book that I labored on for 3 years, was never supposed to be a book. It was me trying to answer a question, which is how Square survived an attack by Amazon. So what happened when we were a startup, 3 years in, Amazon copied our product and lowered their price on what we thought was a commodity, which was credit card processing. So they undercut our price, and then they added the Amazon brand name, and they expected this to work. And frankly, so did we. Because at the time, every time Amazon attacked a startup, 100% of the time, the startup died.
No one had ever survived an attack from Jeff Bezos.
Nobody had ever survived an attack by Amazon. Now, you could argue that Google survived an attack, you know, but they were already Google, right? So monsters fighting monsters. But like monsters fighting squirrels, the squirrel's dead.
Yeah, it was like a goldfish versus a great white.
Yeah, it was not a fair fight, and everyone expected us to be dead. And so we actually looked at, and the reason I know nobody survived an attack by Amazon was I was looking for another company that we could model our behavior after, you know, copy, who had survived Amazon. Well, we'll do what they did. Well, there was nobody. So we looked at our options. We didn't have many options. I mean, we can't become Amazon overnight. We don't have a brand. We don't, you know, like you probably have a listening device from Amazon in your home. People pay Amazon to, you know, put a bug in their living room. Have any of that? We don't have flying robots. So there wasn't much we could do. So all we did was basically continue to, you know, serve our customers, build our product. And the amazing thing happened about a year later, Amazon quit. So Amazon, after attacking us for a year, said, we're out. And they mailed one of our little Square readers to all their soon-to-be former customers and said, go to Square. We're not going to do this anymore. So the question is, what happened? Like, this doesn't happen. Like, startups don't survive Amazon's attacks. But Square somehow did. So what explains that? And I couldn't answer this question. So I spent personally about 2 years researching and looking for patterns and looking for other companies or other systems that had survived. Like, when does the goldfish survive the attack by the shark? You know, like, when is that battle won by the little fish? And it turns out there is a pattern. It turns out it's rare. Like, you don't see it a lot. But I saw the pattern. And in order to find it, because it's not a common pattern, I had to look back in history, and most of the people that I was studying had already died. Okay. So in order to get the data, I was reading history, but I couldn't talk to anybody. except for one guy. His name was Herb Kelleher. He was the legendary founder of Southwest Airlines, and he agreed to speak with me. And so I flew down to Dallas and met with Herb for a day in his office, and he smoked two packs of Cool Menthols while I was there. And we talked about how when Southwest was this little startup airline that everyone expected to be crushed by the majors, they not only survived, but they became the biggest airline in the country. Like, they beat United and they, by any measure for the first 20 years under Herb, Southwest was kicking everyone's ass. Now, interestingly, in my book, I predicted Southwest's current problems because they'd changed their behavior. And so in my book, I call out, I was like Southwest is going down. And they did.
Wow.
For exactly the reasons I think that I anticipated. But the pattern was really interesting. And so what happened at that meeting was, you know, at the end of the day, I was like, Mr. Kelleher, thank you. I am done. This is it. You've answered my question. I'm super grateful. And he was like, well, not so fast, kid. How are you going to share this data with the world? Like, how are you going to share your insight with somebody besides just you? And I got to paint the scene here. We got Herb Kelleher, who is a legend, who has this deep baritone voice. And he is pacing around his office. He can't sit still. So I'm sitting on his couch. I'm staring up at this guy. He's gone through two packs of Cool Menthols. So there is this cumulus layer of, you know, cloud in the office. And I get this deep baritone voice booming down at me, like, how are you going to share this with me? It was like hearing God give you an edict.
I was going to say, it sounds like a spiritual experience.
This deep voice coming down from a cloud and telling you to do something. And so I was like, oh, you know, and by the way, I revered Herb Kelleher. He was a legend. And so I resolved then and there to figure out a way to share it with the world. And what resulted is the innovation stack was me rewriting the book 8 times until it was good enough to impress even Herb.
Wow.
But I agonized over that book. I rewrote the whole thing 8 times. And it reads, if you read it, I know most people don't read these days, but if you read it, I promise you, it will not read like a business book. Like, you have fun with it. But
it's absolutely masterful, and it got me thinking, what is my innovation stack, and how can I think through each unique point of this business? Because the interesting thing is, for an innovation stack to be successful, each part of the stack has to be successful, right? If there's any weak link, you lose the innovation stack, which I think played into your decision to not do anything when Amazon attacked. You said, okay, well, we have all these moats, essentially, that we're competing on, and we have to, all these must be true for us to win. And if we deviate from any of these, then we're going to fall right into their trap.
Yeah. So what I was trying to do, and I'll get into a little, so the meat of the book, because most people won't read it, but here's the central theme. Okay. And that is, almost everything you do in your life as a known solution before you attempt it. Okay, so I learned how to fly planes. Great. I just paid guys who knew how to fly planes to teach me how to fly planes. I didn't have to invent anything. I have not added any bit of innovation to the world of aviation. Zero. You know, I'm a very good pilot, but I have not contributed anything to the knowledge set. And this is true for most of our lives. Almost everything you want to do, somebody else has done. There's a YouTube video. There's a course. You can figure it out. You can hire an expert. You can go to a trade show. That's most of your life. In fact, for most people, it's all of their lives. You will never do anything original in your entire life. And I'm not knocking people. I'm saying that that's good behavior. Like, I'm not going to eat an original lunch today. Like, I'm going to go out and I'm going to eat something. I don't know what I'm going to eat, but whatever it is, humans have eaten it for a long time. You know, it will be not original. So, what happens if you encounter a problem that we don't have a YouTube video for? Like, if you encounter a problem where there isn't a known solution, so you bump up against that edge of human knowledge, you just, like, nobody's ever done this. And what do you do? And at that moment, what'll happen is your fear response will kick in. And this fear response is protective. It's your body and your mind telling you Don't be out of the herd. Don't get out of the other group of penguins, right? The SEALs are coming. We got to stick together. Like the herding instinct is wired into us. And it's for good reason, because like humans behave well when they're in sync with other humans. Like if you, like I was kind of psyched that you were wearing a sweater today. Like I'm looking at you, you got a nice, I mean, you got better physique than I do, but I was like, thank God he's got a sweater on. Cause like if you'd been in a suit or something, I would have felt weird because I'm wearing a sweater. You know, even that little thing.
Yeah.
Humans like to be in sync. So if you end up doing something that humans have not done before, where you can't copy a solution, every fiber of your body will tell you you're wrong. And then all your friends will tell you you're wrong because they're going, Chris, what are you doing, man? Chris, what? Don't do that. Come, go back to the hurt, you know. And my 300-page book describes what it's like in this world where you can't copy. And believe me, you have never spent time in this world. I didn't even realize what I was doing. As a matter of fact, for most of my career, I felt like such an idiot because every time I would do something that was truly different, I would feel all this fear and I would feel all this hesitation. And I was having panic attacks. I was pretty freaked out. And it turns out that was actually an appropriate response, but I didn't know that I was doing anything different. I thought, well, I'm just trying to do this thing. And I didn't realize that there's this totally different set of rules. When you can copy, the rules are known. When you can't copy, it's a wild world. And so the innovation stack is this thing that evolves when you can't copy. It is the result of living in this world where the solutions aren't known in advance and you have very few tools and weapons. And so you have this very limited toolkit and you got to learn to use it. And so that's what I talk about in the book. And my hope, and this is the reason I want people to read the book. One, it's kind of a fun read. But two, at some point in your life, maybe you're going to find a problem that the world has not solved yet. Maybe it's something you care about and you want this thing and it doesn't exist. And you can't buy it on Amazon. You can't find it on YouTube. It's this thing you want. You say, God damn it, I want this in the world and it's not here. Like right now, I want a plastic-free diaper. Like I want a diaper that doesn't have any plastic in it at all. Okay, doesn't exist. Really hard problem. You come to that moment, almost everything about you is going to say, stop, Chris, don't do anything. My book, if you read it and understand it, will prepare you to cross that line. I'm not guaranteeing it will work. There's no promise of success when you're doing something that hasn't been done. But don't accept the lack of qualification as an excuse. Because like, I mean, back to pilots. Were Wilbur and Orville Wright qualified pilots? Oh, they couldn't be. You can't be qualified if you're the first person to fly. Like if you are the first person to stick an airplane in the air and try to figure it out in the air, you're not qualified. I'm a way better pilot than Orville Wright was, but he was the first guy to fly. Or maybe it was Wilbur. I don't know. They flipped a coin. I can never remember. But the point is, you're not qualified to do this new thing, but neither is anybody else on the planet. So if it's truly new, don't stop. Don't hesitate. Because I don't want the talent of the world, the people who can do new things, to disqualify themselves just because they're used to following their gut, their instinct, their body, their physiology, because that's what your gut's going to say, stop. And what my discover, I mean, thousands of people have discovered this, but I wrote the book on it. That fear that you feel is completely natural and it serves you well in most of your life, but don't live with it if you're trying to do something new. In that case, we got to have a new set of rules. And that's what the innovation stack's about.
And it's really exciting because that's where a lot of the progress in the world is, right? It's the true innovators, disruptors that go completely against the grain and wander the unknown and pioneer new things that help humanity that everyone else can kind of stack on the off the back of.
Yes, but don't make it sound cool, okay?
It's kind of
cool,
Jim.
You were starting to make it sound cool.
It's kind of cool, Jim. It's kind of badass.
But it's cool. It's cool in hindsight when it works, but here's the thing. If you think it's going to be cool when you start, and then you feel this fear and you feel awkward and you feel all this other uncool stuff, you'll say, well, I'm not doing it right. I need to rewatch Chris's podcast, or I need to do, like, if your expectation is, I'm going to be cool, I'm going to be an innovator, I'm going to nail this, dude, you're going to be so disappointed. So don't make it sound like, I wanted to make it sound brutal, and it is brutal,
mm-hmm.
and it's terrifying. And I know there are people who sort of glorify this, but I've never met anyone who's cool who's done it, who was cool while they were doing it. You know, you can become cool later. Yeah, cool will steal you wrong. The need to be cool in the early days. Hey, man, if it works, yeah. I guess it's cool if it works, but
yeah, to the public. But yeah, in terms of, so for people here that have that audaciousness in them, a word that you love, they're a true definition of an entrepreneur. And they said, you know what, I want to go in the wilderness, and, or maybe it's not that I want to go be a disruptor for the sake of being a disruptor, but there's a problem. They discover that they just feel this obsessive urge. They have to solve it. Like this is just their mission, but there is no blueprint. For someone in that situation right now, can you break down just some takeaways from the innovation stack? Is how does someone actually come up with their innovation stack? And what does that kind of foundational process look like to get that right?
Okay, so you point at a problem. So I spent the last 5 years trying to build a plastic-free diaper. I have tested thousands, and I'm not making that out, thousands of different substances, different materials, different things. Because plastic's actually pretty cool, except it lasts for a millennium, right? The problem with a diaper is that it lasts 10 times as long as the kid. The kid's good for about 100 years. The diaper's good for about 1,000.
Wow.
Like in a landfill, that thing will be there 10x as long as the child is. So I was like, well, how do we fix this? And I thought, well, there are probably some plastic alternatives. Turns out there are not. There aren't like bioplastics and all that stuff. That's all crap. But there are natural substances that you can engineer around if you've got it. I still don't have a working diaper. I was in the lab last week working at a way to get eucalyptus fiber to absorb urine and to modify. Like, we're playing with all this stuff. It's starting to work, but here's how you build an innovation stack. Don't worry about the innovation stack. Focus on the problem. The problem for our team is make a diaper that fits and is comfortable and safe. It doesn't use any plastic, right? And with that as the mission, we have, you know, about 20 man years of research so far into this product. And we have built an innovation stack of probably 20 or 30 things that we do differently than normal diaper manufacturers. And our product still doesn't work. The reason I'm not saying, oh, go out and buy my diaper, I can't sell you one. It doesn't work. Damn thing leaks all over the place. Like it's a mess right now. But we are edging towards that solution. And if we ever get it, then we will have this innovation stack of inventions that were necessary to produce that result.
Interesting. So the innovation stack is only successful in hindsight. You're kind of testing all these different things that you say would do differently from first principles to solve a problem that has not been solved before. And then once you have the result in hindsight, you can then look backwards and say, okay, these were the factors in combination that allowed this success.
Yeah, you see it in hindsight. Because you can't... You can hypothesize about what would work, but look, until you do it and it works, you don't know. And the problem with unsolved problems is that we don't know which the solution is. And it might be counterintuitive, or it might be a compound solution. It's so incredibly complex to do stuff that hasn't been done. Well, at least I've never been able to just say, oh, well, we'll do this, 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 and then it'll work. Now I have ideas like that, and then we try it. And we literally had an explosion in the lab the other day. Like, it was the funniest thing in the world. You know, like an honest to God, old school, covered in synthetic urine.
Oh, no.
Shit blows up in your face. Well, this was piss blows up in your face. But it was literally, we had an explosion in the lab. How cool is that, right? One of the things, that one of the chemicals we were trying turned out to be a big oxidizer. We got this oxygen bubble. It formed under all this sludge. And then, you know, because we're moving kind of fast. We got some lasers and stuff. Like, man, the oxygen comes up and hits a flame. Explosion and synthetic blue pee all over everybody. I didn't see it coming. I've been taking a urine shower. I mean, it's just, you can't make this stuff.
Jim, what motivates you to do these things, man? Like, you have all these different passions and projects you're running in parallel. What is driving you to build these things?
Well,
do you just
love
doing novel things that have never been done before? Is that the...
I mean, no, that's fun, but it's not so much that. I mean, I get as freaked out and scared as anybody, maybe more so. I mean, look, to your listeners, I don't want to sugarcoat this. Chris, we had to reschedule this podcast. Was the last time we tried to do it, which was just a week ago. I was having like a panic attack, and I haven't had one of those in like 12 years. But I literally cut off the interview. You were very kind, but I cut the interview off because I wasn't able to handle my shit. And I don't know what it was, because I had about 5 things going wrong at the same time. And I don't know which one, you know, was in my subconscious, or maybe it was just you. You know, I don't know. It was your fault. But like, don't expect that I'm some role model or anything, but I will tell you what my process is. I deeply care about certain things. And ever since Square made me rich, I now have all these resources that I didn't have before. So I feel even more guilty by just sitting around and playing. And don't worry, I play a lot, but I can't just play. Like, I can't just, you know, whack golf balls or fly planes or, you know, play with my kid. I love playing with my kids. They're great. But it would be such a waste for me to squander all these resources and not try to attack some problems. So like, who's going to build a plastic-free diaper right now and not sell out to Procter & Gamble if it works, right?
It has to be someone who's got a lot of money and isn't doing it for the money.
Yeah, because if P&G shows up and you're not a billionaire and they say, hey, would you like to be? You're probably going to sell out. It's cool to be a billionaire. Like it's, you know, put it on the bucket list.
Jim, what I love about you, man, is you're like the antithesis to what you think a billionaire would be. Like, I know a lot of founders, their goal is to build generational wealth. And I think that it's a primary goal for a lot of people. And they eventually find out that it wasn't really the main thing. But for you, they want to be in your position. But I'm curious, has being a billionaire actually changed your daily life in a meaningful way?
Yeah, but it wasn't all positive. I mean, what it's done, it's made things kind of weird. Because in the old days, nobody wanted to talk to me unless they wanted to talk to me. And these days, people pretend they want to talk to me when they actually want to talk to my money. So, and I've gotten a little more attuned to this, but like for the first few years, I was like, oh, this guy's being really nice. And I was like, oh, wait a second. I'm more nervous than I was before because I don't trust people as much as I used to. Because, you know, the old gym when I was, you know, sort of like I had plenty of money. I've always had money. At least that's not true. I've always had way more money than I could spend. Like, I just don't have a lavish lifestyle. So it never mattered. When the money shows up, I was pretty much unprepared for these really sophisticated, very smooth people who are super skilled, you know, ingratiating themselves with me and my family. Some of them are actually friends now, but I there's an asterisk by all those sort of friendships. As like, oh, you're post IPO, you know, I don't. So, and that kind of sucks because I used to be able to just, you know, I mean, I hung out with a bunch of crazy folks, you know, a lot of artists, a lot of, you know, guys who were in prison, people who were I don't know, just not sort of mainstream white America. And now I'm more guarded, and that sucks. But every time I let my guard down, I get pitched unbelievably. I had a guy, I was at this glass conference the other guy, you know, some dude who's a glass artist. He's like, Jim, we have to talk. I was like, yeah, sure, let's talk. And he wants me to like set up some nonprofit and pay him some insane salary. And I know the guy's insane. Like, so I had to say no, but I was like, I just had to sit through and I'm like, what am I going to do? I mean, so I'm just not whining about it. Well, I am whining about it. Don't feel bad for me. Don't feel sorry. But it's not all positive. And I wish, here's the thing, Chris, I see some billionaires. I'm in like billionaires. Man, they got awesome houses. They got, you know, all sorts of stuff. And I kind of look at it and I'm like, boy, it'd be cool to be that. And then this little voice in my head goes, Jim, you could just buy that if you want. Like, you could just go get that. Anything. I don't care. Like, I thought I don't value it that much. I thought I did. I don't.
It's interesting because I feel like it begs the question, what is the most important thing in life? You know, and obviously money is a tool and we can use it to expand our options and live better lives in many ways. But if you think about it, it's probably health and the quality of your relationships. And in some way, becoming a billionaire made that harder for you to actually just build authentic relationships. It probably, I imagine, makes you value the ones you have more.
Yes, yes. If I can somehow vet somebody, that is a truly precious relationship. If I feel like they're being honest and will tell me when I'm doing something stupid, because I do a lot of stupid stuff, I mean, daily. So the feedback is super helpful. And look, and those are the old friends. Those are the family. There are a couple of new friends, but it's like the new friends, they also have to have the same disease, right? So other billionaires, okay, cool. Super famous people, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, like as long as they are used to this sort of weird treatment, then we can get on. Like a couple of my friends are, you know, super famous people. And it's not because I'm drawn to super famous people. It's just that, oh, they understand it. They get it too. I got one of my friends, he's so, like, he doesn't have to press the walk signal when we cross the street. The traffic just stops. And I was walking across the street with him. This is down in Miami. And we were walking across the street. And the bar stop and the windows go down and they're shouting at him. And I'm like, how do you deal with this? Like, how do you deal with this on a daily basis? He's like, Jim, I stay home. Like, it turns out he and I were taking the first walk he'd taken in a while.
Wow.
I was like, man.
Yeah.
How do you handle that? There's a guy. Two guys I really felt sorry for. One is him. I can't use his name. The other guy, was a government servant who is now targeted for death by a nation state. The nation state put out a hit on this guy. And he's okay. He's alive. But I brought him over to the office. He travels with this entourage of protection. Like his life is look at that. There's a hole in my, I just saw that on camera. Hole in my sweater. Shit.
You don't care about impressing people, Jim. Just leave the hole.
Uniqlo. But what this guy did for our freedom to protect us, like he's kind of sacrificed his life. Because like this, nation states don't give up on this stuff. Like they put out a death threat on you. You live with, you know, black SUVs and guys with earpieces the rest of your life. And we'll probably keep him alive. But man, his life is, yeah, he can't go, you know, grab a piece of pizza at 2 a.m.
Is the trade-off worth it?
I don't know. Like, he served our country, and now he is in this situation.
Jim, are you spiritual at all? I'm curious. Like, I know Jack is big into spirituality and meditation, loves autobiography of a yogi, and is very into that world. But do you consider yourself a spiritual person?
No.
More pragmatic, more practical?
I mean, I don't know that pragmatism is the opposite of spiritualism. I just know that every time I meditate, I feel silly, and I don't think I do it right. I mean,
But how do you build Square and go through that much hell battling Amazon, all the regulation? I mean, that is not an easy company to build. How do you do that without some incredible level of faith in something greater?
I mean, the credit goes to others. Like, that wasn't me. I'm the guy that comes up with the idea and does the stuff when nobody knows how the product's going to work. Once the product works, I'm out, you know, like the building of Square, the fighting of Amazon, like all that stuff happened. I mean, Jack was in charge, but there was a complete management team underneath it. They were, you know, hundreds of people, actually now thousands, that make that thing run. That's not me. I'm the guy that starts the new thing. So when you have a problem that hasn't been solved before, I'm a very good guy to have on that team. When the solution is known, you probably don't want me.
You're bored at that point.
Well, I'm disruptive. Because I'm like, yeah, so what? We know how to do this. Well, let's talk about something we don't know how to do. Like, I'm constantly pushing to the thing that we don't know how to do. I didn't fight that battle. I started the company, you know, and the idea. And in the early days, I think I had a lot of value. But as time grew, we hired people that were better than me at everything I was doing. So there's no point in me doing it. And then you only need a little bit of vision, like a little bit of vision. And then, you know, a decade of execution. So the vision, yeah, but execution, not me.
I'm curious. You talked about in the book, too, how like money and fame, they're just weak motivators. Like if you're doing it to be cool, you're probably screwed before you started. Because you study patterns, are there particular motivations that lead to the highest probability of success?
Oh, yes. Passion. Caring. I usually look for it in a negative form. I usually look for it in the form of anger. People who are pissed off about something that they think is wrong in the world are usually willing to get up 20 times after you knock them down 19. That to me has been a proxy. Now, I don't want just angry people around, but like if you are sort of righteously indignant about something that you think is wrong and you want to fix, okay. I get it. I like that. And that's a good motivator. You know, the money and fame thing, because it's kind of become cool to be an entrepreneur now. But I mean, entrepreneur, I should define the word because I use the word in the book, but I use the ancient definition. When I use the word entrepreneur, its original meaning, this is 150 years ago, was somebody in business who was doing something weird. It was not somebody who was starting a business. So the way we use entrepreneur today means you've started a company. Start a coffee shop, we call you an entrepreneur. I would not say entrepreneurs start coffee shops anymore because coffee shops are a solved problem. We know how to build a coffee shop. There's a trade show. There are, you know, the La Marzocco machine is a solved problem. Call your coffee something else or say it's organic or I don't know. Say everyone's calling it organic. Like, why don't you use pesticide coffee? Like I don't know. There's a missing word in the English language for what I describe. The entrepreneur, somebody who is doing something that hasn't been done before and therefore has a different set of rules. That's precious and that's hard to discuss. And look, we have so little time. I just want to keep the focus on the stuff that's not being talked about. And the thing that I've found that it's really hard to talk about is a concept for which the English language doesn't even have a word. So this is the first freak out that I had when I was writing the book. So I was like, I got all this insight and I go to write the first, you know, words of the book. And I'm like, oh shit. English does not have a word for the thing I have to describe. Full stop, project on hold, go into history, find out that, oh, we used to have a word. We used to have a word, but the word got co-opted, right? So now entrepreneurship is this thing that's cool. Like when I was starting it, like when I first started my companies, like nobody was doing that. The only people that worked with me were freaks and weirdos and people who had, you know, some sort of personality disorder. They weren't fitting in, so they would do their own thing. Or come join me on my weird thing.
100%. And I would love to get your take on this, Jim, because for me, at least starting a business, a lot of it initially was born out of pain. I hated seeing the way things were currently done. I also was definitely more the outsider growing up. So I had that, you know, I want to go prove myself to the world for the first couple of years of starting the company. But there was a lot of pain. Like, I found a lot of founders that I have worked with that are mega successful, have had a lot of trauma, but they figured out how to alchemize it and channel it for better purposes, right? And I know for you, you had a pretty significant event, and I think it was 89 when your mom took her life. Do you feel like that was a defining moment in you as an entrepreneur? And I'm just curious how that changed your trajectory.
I mean, it did for a couple of reasons. The biggest was that my mom's suicide, which followed a bout of depression, was one that I didn't take any action to solve because, you know, I was young and my mom was in, had a therapist and a psychiatrist, and we thought she was being taken care of. Like, we thought, oh, the professionals will handle this. You know, the people who know will handle this. And then I very suddenly lose my mother. And I'm thinking, man, there was way more I could have done. Like, as her son, I could, because of course, look, I had a bunch of free time because I was, you know, blowing glass. I could have done more to save my mother, and I didn't. And you don't get to replay that. Mom's gone. So what happens then in my head? And the answer is, I have always felt when I see a problem that I think needs solving, it just brings up this well of emotion. It's like back when, like, I could have done something about my mom and I didn't. And I could do something about this thing. Now, I'm not sure that's going to work, but I just can't sit on the sideline. And so these days it's, you know, I've got four or five things simultaneously happening. But in every case, I'm pushing something that I care about. Now, look, you may not care about a plastic-free diaper. I felt super guilty when I had my kids and I was filling up the world with plastic. And I was like, why isn't anybody doing anything about this? But then I realized that, you know, there were good reasons. It was a tough problem. And I was like, well, I should work on it. You know, these days we've got all these drugs that are tremendous. There's a phenomenal amount of discovery going on. We don't get more than 30 approved substances out of the FDA every year. And it's not the FDA's fault. The FDA is maintaining the scientific standard, but there is this tremendously slow and expensive system to make drugs approved that if we don't streamline it, we're all going to die of something that would be curable. So somebody's got to work on this. I mean, and there are people working on this, but like, I want to join that fight. And I think that does stem from my mother. I had a chance to do something and I didn't. And I feel that guilt. And so that's probably not a great motivator. Well, I'm sorry. It is a great motivator. It's not a positive motivator.
Yeah, but it's also beautiful, I think, because like, you can't go back and change that, but you can use pain to make the world better, to upgrade the world. And if you didn't have that pain, it's like you wouldn't have the same level of emotional fuel and audacity in that relentless fight, because there's something you hate so much that you're willing to fight until it's eradicated. I think that's beautiful, and I think it's powerful, and I think these things all happen to us, but we can choose what to do with that energy afterwards. And I think that's it's an amazing thing.
Well, I believe in motivation. I don't believe in positive motivation. Like, whatever gets you going. Like, I would rather it be positive. But if it's panic, fine. If it's fear, fine. What's it going to take for you to do the thing?
I got one last question for you.
Sure.
Have you seen The Men in Black?
The movie? Yes.
Yeah. You've seen that movie? Okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Do you remember there's a pen in that movie called the Deneuralizer?
Yes, the neuralizer, yes.
Yeah, so when you get zapped with the Deneuralizer, it wipes your memory. You have to start over a new life, but you have no memory. If you were about to get Deneuralized, but you could write down one message to yourself to take into your next life, what would you write down?
Well, in my case, I'd write down the title of my book, right? You know.
You read it, you're like, what the hell's the innovation stack? What was this guy thinking?
Yeah, I would just basically try to download that back into my brain because it took me 25 years to figure it out. 25 years of failures to figure it out, but without being blatantly self-promotional. I guess I'd just write, don't quit, you know? Because I don't know where you're going to wipe out. right? Are you going to wipe out since before my mother? Are you going to wipe out my childhood? Are you going to wipe out, like, because I got wired weird. Like, I don't know what happened in my childhood that made me so stubborn, but that stubbornness has been a very positive asset. It's also destroyed some relationships. It's caused massive financial disasters. Like, but that stubbornness ultimately has been very helpful, I think. At least I tell myself that. If I could hand myself the book, I would. If I could hand my younger self the book, that was the thing that I was like, God, I wish I'd known this stuff when I was in my 20s as opposed to in my 40s. Because this is a couple of wasted decades of me making just flat out wrong assumptions because the rest of the world has the same problem. And we are all so ignorant about what it's like to do something innovative that there literally aren't words. I mean, that would be the thing I'd try to hand myself, but I couldn't. It would just be, you know, don't quit on a pad of paper. And then wipe my brain out. We'll start again.
I love it. Well, guys, go read The Innovation Stack. It's actually a remarkable book. It's definitely top five, I would say, business book, but it extends beyond business, I think, too. It's just kind of more, how do you live your life? How do you be bold and audacious and navigate the unknown and create the life you dream of? So, Jim, thank you, man. This has been inspiring, super tactical. Really appreciate you doing this.